day two of pathology. All right, a few other things before we go to acute inflammation that I want to have you think about. In terms of cell injury, one of the things you have to think about, the body is a dynamic process, and they have all these different organ systems. And when you have use of tissues, as well as when they become diseased, you have to realize that one of the things that happens is that cells degenerate and they become like fossils. We call this calcification. We can form stones in the kidney because we concentrate urine, and we have calcium at high concentration can precipitate a supersaturated solution. We get gallstones, for example, is another organ system where you have a lot of secretions. But then you have tissues that degenerate, like your arteries, like you've done your, when you go through the gross anatomy, you get to the visceral organs, and you feel the aorta, and somebody that's very old, they can have hardening of the arteries or atherosclerosis, where they get dystrophic calcification or calcification of degenerating plaques or hardening of the arteries. So your choroid plexus that you use to make your CSF, if you look at somebody on a CT scan in their 80s, you'll notice it's calcified because it's had 8 decades plus less than 9 months of use. And so things degenerate as you go through this process. So we call this dystrophic calcification, and we can see it in non-viable as well as dying tissues or diseased tissues. This is what radiologists will use as a way of chronic pancreatitis. You see calcification in your pancreas because it's been chronically damaged versus acute. Or you have somebody who has old granulomatous disease due to TB, and they see calcified nodules in the lung. So calcifications are a way of looking at it. Or if you destroy a joint, you can see calcifications or arteries that become calcified. So there's various conditions that we can think of that can lead to this. And so we think of, it can be calcium comes into cells. We talked about this yesterday. It's evil for cells. It causes damage, but they can precipitate calcium in the acute as well as chronic phase as part of cell injury. What are some examples? Atherosclerosis. We'll talk about this when we get to the cardiovascular later in October. In thinking of the hardening of the arteries, it becomes calcified and it's irreversible. Tumors produce a variety of calcifications, like breast cancer, for example, or in the case of the thyroid and tumors of the ovaries where they have finger-like projections called papillaries, they go through calcifications. We see this microscopically, and we call these somoma bodies. And if you hear that term, somoma, you would say, why would they call something a somoma? What the heck is a somoma? And somoma means next time you're walking on a sandy beach, you're walking on somoma bodies. Somoma means sand. So these are the size of the granules of sand that you're walking on. So you're laying on a beach somewhere, think of the somoma bodies you're laying that towel on. So this is a form of calcifications that occur as a consequence of degeneration within the tumor, and this can be used. This is what it looks like. Here you see these purple-like structures, and that's what it looks like in an H&E. Hematoxin binds to calcium salts and hematoxin nucleic acids, and you can see it looks like a geoid stone. When I see go to a museum, natural science or earth, and I see those geoid stones, I think of those laminations like a somoma body. They don't get it, it's quite as big though. This is all microscopic. Another type of calcification is widespread, where you have somebody who has hypercalcemia. Where is 99% of your calcium stored in the human body? Bone, 99%. Only 1% is ionized, because that's a critical ion that you want to control. Otherwise, it can precipitate cellular injury if we have too much calcium. It's also a problem if you don't have enough calcium. So what happens in this case, calcium is what charge to it? Positive 2. So it's looking for what? Negatively charged. And that becomes important because it's going to bind to proteins and produce calcification. So since calcium is circulating in the blood, the first structure is going to calcify are your blood vessel walls. And so we call this metastatic, being widespread. And so that becomes important. When you hear that term, metastatic, it means it's all through the body and the vessels are become calcified. So the vessels become calcified, what happens to its compliance or stiffness? The compliance decreases, the stiffness increases, and so now what happens, do you think, to your peripheral resistance? Increases, so the patient now develops hypertension because you don't have it stiff, and so you're causing increased pulmonary resistance is a problem, okay? And so there are many causes. The glands that control the calcium reabsorption from your bone since 99% is stored there, is the parathyroids that sit right behind your left and right lobe of your thyroid, which is in your neck right here. And they're by the size of lentil seeds. So next time you see lentil seed, think of parathyroids. That's the size of your parathyroid normally. And so they become very important. So if you have hyperplasia, more cells of the parathyroids, then you make more parathyroid hormone and you're going to lead to hypercalcemia. There are other diseases. We'll come across this again when we talk about granulomatous disease next week. We take a chronic, and that is sarcoidosis. It's a condition of systemic granulomas, and the macrophages that make up a granuloma secrete, or they're able to hydroxylate vitamin D. We know vitamin D is important, hydroxylation by the liver and the kidney, so it basically will skip the liver and increase hydroxylation of vitamin D, therefore you have more active vitamin D. And what does vitamin D do to your gut? It increases the absorption of calcium, and that can lead to hypercalcemia. So there's various conditions. If you had disease that destroy the bone, like leukemia, which is a malignancy that arises in the bone marrow, it destroys the bone. What do you release into the blood? Calcium. So 99% of your calcium is stored where? Your bones. So there are a lot of diseases that can release it. If you drank 2 or 3 gallons of milk a day, you could get hypercalcemia, by the way. So moderation is the key to life. Any extreme is a problem. Even too much exercise is a problem. So it'll go through all these different blood vessels. Now, what do you do with a list as a student? When before an exam, what do you do with a list? You memorize it, don't you? Obediently, right? Because you're trying to survive as the adaptive process. What happens to that list after the exam?
It's gone.
It's gone. And then you go to another class and they ask the same list. What do you do again? Memorize again. It's a repetitive process, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just imagine if you started school, how much vacation time you could use now if you didn't have to memorize the list. Is there a better way?
Yes.
We're going to go back to the third grade. Even the third grade should be a prerequisite for graduate school, even medical school. So what do you look for when you do the mathematical operation, when you take one half and add it to one third? What are you always looking for? Right. Any list in medicine, I don't care what the list is, if they generate a list, you always ask the question is, what is the common denominator that generates it? Now we're going to apply it to this list. Kidneys, lungs, gastric mucosa, and blood vessels. What do they have all in common? This is more sophisticated. It's more of a qualitative rather than quantitative. What do the kidneys, lungs, and gastric mucosa have all in common that allow calcium to deposit? They are very
vascularized.
That is right. What's the one tissue you would not tend to see it in? Cartilage, because it has no blood vessels. Very good. See how you do it? Now we can add to that list. Give me 3 more organs that you would add, because there's that et cetera. Think of things that have organ systems that have a lot of blood vessels that you would expect them to be affected. The liver?
Heart?
What are you using right now to figure out the answer?
Brain.
Yeah, you better be using that one. It needs a lot of blood vessels. And what's the largest organ in the body? Skin, highly vascularized too. See? When we write exams, what do you think, if board exams apply to you as well, is we're going to ask you, we're going to pick a condition that comes from that list, but we're really asking about what? The common denominator concept that generates that list. So if you understand that, then does it matter what they pick? No. That's why I wish I could go back to school and take exams again. It'd be so much fun. It's like having cardinal knowledge. Once you figure out how to do this, and you should bring me any list. I don't care what course you're studying. I can find that common denominator for you. And then I can generate the list at will. And I never have to memorize a list ever again. And who needs an iPhone or any phone? I got it up here now. And it doesn't depend upon recharging, except at night. So here's what it looks like. This is a blood vessel in the lung, and calcium is purple. And you see those arrows pointing to the purplish stuff in the wall? We know the lung is highly vascularized, so you can imagine calcium, where you see the red blood cells in the center, is going to bind to the negatively charged proteins, the amino acids, and now calcify it. And what happens to its stiffness? It gets stiffer, and therefore resistance. And what side of the heart is going to be affected, left or right, if it has pulmonary resistance? The right side. And that right heart is going to have to work harder, and then we have problems, and we have failure of the heart as a consequence of this. Okay? Hyaline change. This is a microscopic term. You'll see this term. It's in your syllabus. It's pink. So hyaline means it has protein in it. And so basically it's homogeneous. Whoops. And basically it means protein. There's interest because there's proteins that can occur in cells. We call them hyaline droplets in the proximal tubule cells of the kidney. We're going to go over this when we get to the kidney. When somebody has too much protein that's getting into the filtrate through the glomerulus, it gets absorbed, and you get these hyaline droplets. Or you have conditions where you have proteins that are made by cells like plasma cells that make antibodies. They make so much of it, they can't get it out, and it produces what are called Russell bodies. I'm not going to ask you to memorize this for the exam, so these are just examples. Viral inclusions. When you have viruses that are true human parasites, they're encased with viral capsid proteins that can either contain RNA or DNA nucleic acids. And when they produce these inclusion cells, it gives a pink color. Then damage to hepatocytes due to alcohol, where you have cytoskeletal protein accumulating, and we call these Mallory bodies or alcoholic hyaline. But it can be seen in other conditions, but it's prevalent in this. This is what it looks like. This is a premature infant. We're looking at the kidney. And what you're seeing is these large pink inclusions. This happens to be cytomegalovirus inclusion or virus disease. And so this is a consequence. Each of these red structures represents the virus living in the nucleus, and you see the viral particles within the cytoplasm. What does mega mean? Big. So it's cyto, mega, means big cytosol because the virus is replicating in both the nucleus and in the cytosol. It's in the herpes family, this particular virus, and you can be immunocompromised. It's a ubiquitous virus out there, and so this is something that can occur. The next type of hyaline is extracellular, is scarring. This is something you'll be working with very commonly, is people you have to worry about contractions. Then we have tissue damage, especially when you think of the extremities or the torso. And when you think of scarring or fibrosis, it's collagen. And we're going to talk about this at length when we get to the tissue repair next week. Then when you have hyaline arterial sclerosis, this is hardening of your arterioles because the arterioles are usually under physiologic low pressure. But as they're being used after each decade, they become thickened. That's why your blood pressure goes up as you get older, typically, both systolic and diastolic, because of this constant use. Remember, blood vessels are going constant expansion and contraction all the time. And so you can damage biological tissue. So if you exercise 6 hours a day for 7 days a week for 20 years, you're going to damage your tissues. You can overuse biological tissues and damage them. Moderation is key if you want to last a few more decades. Hyalinization, this is it. When we talk about this, when you have chronic damage to any tissue, it means a scarring. An amyloid is an extracellular protein that's an abnormal accumulation where it can't be broken down. We'll get to it later. This is what it looks like in a scar. We always are cosmetically worried about how we look on the outside when we look at our skin. How many people do not have a scar? That's what I thought. You're all scar experts then. And wherever you find a scar, if you were to take a biopsy of that scar right now anywhere in your body, this is what it would look like at an H&E. And when you look at this, you see these bundles of collagen type 1 compared to the normal collagen. Is a scar stronger or weaker compared to normal skin? What do you think? You would think it'd be stronger, but it isn't. It's weaker. And you say, why? Just because I put something more into something, it should make it stronger? No. If you think of the skin, it's a mechanical device, isn't it? It has to stretch and elastic recoil. The way it's laid down, its collagen in the dermis, has a very unique orientation. So now I cut the skin, whatever how you got your scar, and then I'm going to fill it in randomly with collagen. But it's not going to be the same arrangement as it was originally. So what would happen to its structural integrity? Decrease. What's a classic example of this in a clinical situation? When a woman gets a cesarean section, whatever the reason, and she now wants to have another child, they will dissuade the woman from giving a vaginal birth because that scar tissue in the uterine wall can rupture during delivery. Yes.
Would that be type 3?
No, it's type 1. Type 3 is the first you lay down, and then it gets remodeled, which we're going to talk about in tissue repair, to type 1. But that type 1 is placed in a random fashion that makes it weaker than the original tissue. Does that make sense? Okay? Yes.
But if you break it apart and then use it normally, won't it reform normally?
No. Everybody's rubbing their scars. What you're doing, why you're rubbing the scars is, what you're doing is you're remodeling it and trying to minimize it. But depending upon the amount of tissue injury, which we'll go and talk about next week, you will see there's a point where maybe for little scars, little chiquitos, but when you get grandes, it's a problem, okay? So it's pink. Let's talk about inflammation. Will you see inflammation in your clinical practice or in your clinical rotations? Will you see inflammation in your clinic? Well, that's what I said, didn't I? I said, will you see? So inflammation, has anybody not had an inflammatory process in their body? Have not during their lifetime? Well, you're experts at that too. Good. So this would be very germane. We're constantly inflamed as human beings. Okay? So when we talk about inflammation, why do we have an inflammatory response? Now this becomes important. This one diagram is the essence of these lectures of inflammation and going on to tissue repair. What's on the x-axis? Time. As a clinician, time is critical to you in a process. Whether you're intervening at a particular point or in prevention, it's always important to realize it's a time frame or story that's being played out. Every organ system has to be constantly challenged by two things. One, microorganisms, viruses, bacteria, fungi, parasites, you name it. But another thing it has to deal with is cells dying. Since we turn over 1 billion cells per hour, we don't feel it, do you? You don't feel the cells coming off. But you're replacing them all the time while you're asleep as well. It doesn't matter. So the system that has to control these microorganisms is your immune system. And we break down the immune system into innate and adaptive. And what does this mean? How many people have taken immunology before? Okay, so we got the other. Don't worry, we're going to get you all up in the same mindset. Doesn't matter. The immune system has to deal with those two things, microorganisms and dead cells or tissues. So it is developed. Innate means you have your soldiers, you have your barriers, and structures in place to take care of the vast majority of these two situations. So it's innate. Your system is already geared to protect. Every organ system has this immunity built into it, whether it's your heart, your lungs, your kidneys, your skin, your eyes, your nose, doesn't matter, your bone. So it becomes critical to understand the normal, whether it's the biochemistry, the anatomy, histology, physiology, but also it's the immune system. Because now you superimpose or disrupt this innate immune system, you are now compromised. So let's look at the first thing. So in the innate, what's a very important that prevents bacteria and other organisms to get into your body is a barrier. We call this the epithelium. We have our skin. You had breakfast or lunch, your GI tract, your respiratory tract, your nasal cavity, your anus from the North Pole to the South Pole. Doesn't matter. These are places where you're constantly being exposed. So these are all lined by epithelial structures. So anything that breaks that epithelial barrier, you're now exposed to what? Microorganisms. Doesn't matter. So it becomes important to know the histology of tissues so that when you see somebody come in or somebody's doing something that's going to break that barrier, you're now prone to infections. Okay? Another important thing you don't see in a slide is that various organ systems, the way it protects itself is the constant production of secretions. If those secretions are stopped, you're immunocompromised. What's a classic example of that? Pee is what? Sterile or non-sterile?
No.
Sterile. Why? Because we constantly make urine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even during exams. Doesn't matter. That constant flow of urine prevents bacteria from going upstream. So any person that has a problem with urinary secretion can get an ascending infection. That's why women get more bladder infections than males, because they have a shorter urethra, so they're more prone to getting E. coli going up into the bladder. And so that's an example. Or you think of the ciliated epithelium of your airways, what we call the mucociliary clearance. That's constantly pushing mucus and bacteria that you inhale, or somebody's coughing in the elevator, and it gets pushed out, you expectorate, you cough it out, and you're good to go. But if you destroy that respiratory epithelium, you're now prone to infections. How many people has never had a zit? All right, you're zit experts, good. I had to do my daughter last night. She had one in her ears. So I took care of her, and now she's all happy. There's pathology everywhere. No one's not immune to it. So why do you get zits in puberty? She's 13, by the way. Way on 30. Why do you get zits when you're in your teenage? Everybody blames it on the hormones. You know, you're behaving funny today. It's the hormones. No. What are you doing? You're having rapid growth during in your organ systems, your bones. That's why you're getting taller. Your voice change, all these things. But one of the things is, when you think of hair follicles, you have hair follicles in your ears, by the way. If you go in there with a magnifying glass and look throughout your body, you'd find hair follicles everywhere. Whether you're a man or a woman, doesn't matter. That's why she got it in her ear. What happens is, you have constant secretions in your hair follicles because you have bacteria all over your skin. You may look clean, but you're covered with bacteria. And where do they like to live? In your hair follicles. And what prevents infections is the constant flow of oil or sebaceum. But now when you're going through puberty, those squamous epithelial cells are proliferating and narrow that gap between the hair shaft and blocks the secretions, and the bacteria get trapped, and now you get acute folliculitis and you get a zit. So what did I have to do? What do you do with a zit?
Leave it.
No, I popped it. Provide relief because it was acutely inflamed, let the flow get out, the pus and the bacteria, and now she's a happy camper. Okay, that's why you get zits. Now, if you sit on your bottom all day, can you get a zit there? Yeah, because what are you doing? You're blocking those pores, and now you get acute folliculitis. That's why lectures are 50 minutes, so you prevent that ability. Okay? There's a reason for all this. There's pathology everywhere. There are two cells that are critical to the innate. They're both phagocytic, acute inflammatory cells, we're going to talk about, and macrophages, monocytes, that make up a granuloma. Monocytes are found both the innate and adaptive. They're very critical to these processes of the immune system. Then we make molecules. What's the fixed pharmacist of the human body? Is your liver, your hepatocytes. They make over hundreds and hundreds of molecules that are critical for the inflammatory process. So if somebody has liver damage, chronic liver damage like cirrhosis, they're immunocompromised because they can't make these molecules like complement, which we'll talk about, have played a critical role. Yes? Neutrophils, PMNs, and a kidney bean-shaped nucleus. We call this a monocyte to become a macrophage. If you want to adopt the perfect child, it would be a macrophage. You feed it anything, it would eat it without question. And we'll talk about this. It's true. It's more exciting at the cellular level, what's going on, and see how it goes. Then we have the adaptive. What does this mean? It means it takes time for the immune system to adapt to the process of microorganisms. So we have make antibodies from B cells that become plasma cells. They're going to bind to these various pathogens, and they're cleared by the immune system. Or we make cells, like T cells, to go after viruses that are hidden within the cell and destroy that cell, kill that cell, so that virus can't replicate and take over and infect other cells. So this takes time to process the antigens and immobilize and proliferate those cells in order to mount a response. Okay? So acute inflammation is innate, and then chronic inflammation is going to be adaptive. And you'll see this as we go through this. So that's an overview. This one slide is how you have to think of the human body. And each tissue organ system have these various components. So acute inflammation, what are the cardinal signs? Rubor, it's red. Why? Because we're going to talk about vasodilation. Why do we have vasodilation when we have acute inflammation? Because we want to, it's a very energy-dependent state of inflammation. So the cells that are fighting off the infection need oxygen and nutrients. And what's another important reason is it provides a way of irrigating the wound or the damaged tissue. When we have an infected wound, what do we pour into it? Normal saline, some type of fluid to irrigate it, to clean it. The body has designed this because when you get vasodilation, you get increased vascular permeability leading to a swelling, and we call this a tumor. So the vasodilation, the vessels are going to dilate, the endothelial cells that line the vessels are going to contract, and they become more porous. And we're allowing rich fluid of proteins, growth factors, immunologic molecules that are critical for the inflammatory process to proceed. And then another is, it's warm. You touch a joint that's inflamed. It's going to be red, swollen, the tumor, and it's going to be hot. And there's hot because of several reasons. Why? You've increased blood flow to it. Plus, you're releasing enzymes that are creating cleavage of double bonds, single bonds, and molecules. And what do you release? Delta Gs. It's an exothermic reaction taking place. So it's hot because of the process that's going on. Tender or dolor, pain. Because when tissue stretches, what are you going to set off? Your sensory nerves. And therefore, assuming that you have sensory nerves, but like in the lung, we have very few sensory nerves, you can have a swelling in the lung and you don't feel it. That's why when you see people say, that's why you notice, let's take Clinton, the pneumonia controversy. You could tell that she thought she was doing fine because she didn't feel what? Pain. No pain. Do you think if she felt pain, she would be going around? No. So if you understand different organ systems, when they do have innervation, like the skin versus the lung, and when you have a disease process like inflammation, you may or may not feel it. So it's always important to know the anatomy of an organ system. Then you can anticipate, rather than memorize a list, you can predict what's going to happen. You can just read the story and say, I know exactly what the diagnosis is, just by listening to the patient. What's another thing is chemical mediators are released, like prostaglandins and leukotrienes. Because what do you give patients who have, you give them analgesics, right? To minimize the pain. So you have chemical mediators, plus you're stretching it. Now you have some people that can't feel pain acquired, they can't feel pain as diabetics because they get sensory neuropathy. So they may step on a tack, you and I step on a tack, we're hitting the ceiling. They walk on a tack, they keep walking because they don't feel a thing. So pain is good. It's our warning system. When that pain is diminished or gone, we got a problem. Then we can hide things because of that. Okay? And obviously you impair the function, a joint, skeletal muscle, your heart, your lungs, your gut, whatever it may. Doesn't matter what organ system, or a hair follicle. You can get a zit. Okay? So those are cardinal signs. So when you're in clinic and you see a patient coming in and complaining about pain, you want to touch it. Want to feel, see what its color. If you got all those characteristics, you call it what? Acute. It's acute inflammation. Doesn't matter what organ system. And this becomes very important. Three components. First thing is vasodilation, the rubor. You're releasing vasodilators that are going to promote blood flow. And there are a number of molecules that do that. We'll talk about that. You're going to increase permeability because you've got to get a lot of oxygen, nutrients, and growth factors because you want to get rid of whatever the agent is or the dead tissue, and then replace it. Okay, now, and what's the inflammatory cell we're going to look at? The cinquinone, that's specific for acute inflammation, is called the neutrophil. And it means neutral because it doesn't stain the granules that contain various molecules to get rid of dead tissue as well as microorganisms. And the cell that evolutionarily was derived to fight off are bacteria, which is the most common organism, and then fungi. That's what it was designed evolutionarily over millions of years. So it will not change on the exam. Not in our lifetime. Let's look at an example of this clinically. Then we're going to get into the components. Here's a person in the lower extremities. You see the right leg is the normal and left leg. What tells me it's acute media flame? What characteristics you see there? Just looking at it before you even touch it.
It's red.
It's red. Rubor. What's another thing? Look at the size of it. It's huge. Tumor. What's another thing? If you were to feel it, what would it feel like to you? Warm. Calor. And if the patient tell you what? Tender. They call it, they complain of pain, you'd elicit tenderness. So this is what is called acute cellulitis, inflammation of your dermis. Will you be seeing this? Absolutely. It's classic. So if we were to go down to the microscopic level, here's normal skin. And when we look at the skin, what do we see? We see the epidermis and the dermis. This is where all your collagen type 1 is. And you notice you can't even see really good blood vessels, can you? Oh, except right here. This is normal. So we always have to have an image of what normal looks like. And let's go to what it looks like in cellulitis. What's the first thing you see that's prominent to your eyes? A lot of blood vessels. There's the rubor, vasodilation. And what do you notice? You see a lot of white space around cells, don't you? And what's that space? Is edema. That's swelling. Because you increase the vascular permeability, it becomes leaky. That's not really space. It's really rich fluid in response to the vasodilation and increased vasodilation and permeability. And now we see all these little blue dots everywhere. And what cells are those? Are the acute inflammatory cells. And that would be the diagnosis of an acute inflammation of the dermis. We call this cellulitis. Acute. Yes?
So those are monophils and...
Neutrophils. No, just neutrophils. And then there are monocytes already living in the tissue to begin with as macrophages. We all have macrophages everywhere except cartilage, but they're nearby. Okay? Any questions? So here is our cast of characters of white blood cells. If we were to look in your blood right now and take a put a smear on a microscope, you'd all look the same. Maybe me. So what does the neutrophil look like? And why the neutrophils are critical? And why are they part of this process? Well, neutrophils represent 2/3 of your white blood cell count. If the predominant white blood cell in your blood right now are neutrophils. And what it looks like is a cell. Another name for neutrophils is called polymorphonuclear. So what part of the cell has different shapes to it is the nucleus. And you notice there's connections to the nucleus, and you have the segmentation, 1, 2, 3. So that's why it's called poly. What does poly mean?
Many
different shapes. And it usually has 3 to 5 segmentations. So this is a neutrophil. And here are the granules. The neutrophils only live 10 hours in your blood. So last night when you were going to sleep at close to midnight, neutrophils were leaving your bone marrow, and now they're dying right now. And you don't even feel it. And this happens. And then the question I would ask is, why do they only live 10 hours? It means that these cells, if they run amok, can cause damage in the body. We got to tightly control these cells because they contain molecules that can cause injury to the body and cause further damage. We don't want that. So we got to control these cells. So what the body does is that what's the cell in your tissues that controls the fate of a neutrophil are their macrophages. The macrophages will allow that cell to stop to go through apoptosis and live another 2 days to complete their task. And then they die, and who eats them?
The macrophage.
You're recycling all the time at the cellular level. And you don't even feel it. Yes?
How can a macrophage tell how old a cell is?
Well, when it comes in, the neutrophil, because they're interacting with one another, neutrophils live where? In your blood. And they're going to be removed by the spleen as it's going through, filtering it, and other organs like the liver has macrophages in the sinusoids, for example. But when it gets in the tissue, they release, well, they prevent these cells from going from apoptosis in order to live 1 or 2 days. Once they complete their task, then the macrophage eats them. Because if you allow the neutrophils, I'll show you what happens when the neutrophils stay along and they get more neutrophils coming in, you get more tissue injury. And you don't want that. Because if you have more tissue injury and you can't regenerate the tissue, what do you replace the tissue with? Scar. Is scarring reversible or irreversible?
Irreversible.
And that's the point. So the body has to really control this tightly. Otherwise, we got problems and we'll see the complications. So the neutrophils is the primary cell. And what is it looking for? How many people floss their teeth? Good. When you floss your teeth, what do you think gets in your bloodstream from your oral cavity? What lives in your oral cavity? Bacteria. Who do you think takes them out? They come in contact, or the macrophage in your spleen. They remove pathogens as you floss your teeth. And so you're taking care of it. You get a bacteremia. So there are going to be all these different ways of removing bacteria that get in your bloodstream that are going to prevent it. So it's both the neutrophils and the macrophages. When you look at this cell here, this is what is called a band. It's an immature neutrophil. And you notice this cell does not have segmentation to it. It's an immature neutrophil. We call this a band. And you'll see this on a peripheral blood smear when they do analysis of somebody you think has an infection. What this tells the physician or yourself is that basically the bone marrow is making more white blood cells to fight off the infection or tissue necrosis. And the macrophage tells the bone marrow through cytokine that will tell it to proliferate, and the bone marrow pushes out faster than they can mature. And we call this a band, and you'll see this. So when you have a band, it means that the bone marrow is responding to some type of infection or damage somewhere, and it's an immunologic response. The second most common cell that represents about 20-25% is a lymphocyte, primarily T cells. And they're going to go after what? Viruses. They're the touchy-feely cell. They like to go around and touch all your cells in the body, make sure you're not a tumor cell, you're not virally infected, you're constantly being touched at the cellular level. Then monocytes. They become macrophages. They circulate and replace the macrophages that live about 60 to 120 days in your tissues. They have to be important there because they got to be dealing with the innate immune system as well as the adaptive. And who orchestrates tissue repair? The friendly macrophage. That's the cell we'll orchestrate. When we get to tissue repair next week, we'll see how important it's the shepherd of tissue repair. So it becomes very important how you look at this. And so the monocytes are about 10 to 15%. Why they're such a small number? Because they're long-lived cells. So you need less of them versus if you have a short-lived cell, you have to have more of them. Wouldn't it make sense? That's why it's predominantly the neutrophil is in your peripheral blood. So the monocyte will become the macrophage in your tissue. Another cell that's out there, it's about 3 to 5%, is the eosinophil. This is the one that you see. It has a bilobed nucleus, has those red granules, and they're important to fight off parasitic infections, as well as this is when you have allergies. How many people have allergies? Okay. When you have an allergy, what's the cell that's coming in? Are eosinophils as a response to it. So when you think of an allergic response, hay fever, asthma, hypersensitivity reaction, type 1 or anaphylactic reaction, you think of eosinophilia. We'll talk about that when we get to the immunopath. The last cell is a basophil. It's basal because it's a blue staining, and it represents 0 to 1%. Not too much happens here. And then these are platelets that are important for clotting with fibrin and your blood vessels. We'll talk about that later. So now what do we have to think of these neutrophils? And this becomes clinically important to you. The neutrophils were designed to fight off, get rid of what two things? Bacteria, fungi, and get rid of dead tissue. Okay? So it has to have enzymes that it has to carry out this, because what does it like to do? It likes to eat. It's a phagocyte. So neutrophils contain, now this is not to be memorized. This is just to show you what becomes important. We know that cells, eukaryotic cells, have plasma membranes. They're made of phospholipids. So do bacteria. In the cell walls, they have phospholipid membranes. So what enzyme would I need to poke a hole or break down a bacterial wall is a phospholipase, an enzyme that breaks down those phospholipids to get access and destroy the organism. What's the color of fresh pus? What's the? No, that's old pus. I want fresh pus. Yellow, that's stale pus. I want fresh right out of the oven. Green, that's right. Fresh pus is green. How many people have had a head cold? Yeah, when you've blown out your nose, coughing up that phlegm, what color is it when it first starts? What color is it? Green, that's fresh pus. You're in the middle of battle. Then when it gets older, what yellow? What color does it change to?
Yellow.
And when it's old pus?
White.
Now, why does it change color? How long do PMNs live outside of the body, out of the bloodstream? 1 or 2 days. There's an enzyme called myeloperoxidase, which we'll talk about. It takes chloride, an ion that's pumped into the phagolysosome where you fast, and it takes hydrogen peroxide. How many people have poured hydrogen peroxide into a wound? Yeah, are you helping things? Why do you put it in there? It bubbles. Oh, I like to see it bubble. I'm doing something good for the patient. No. Hydrogen peroxide is taken by this molecule, your acute inflammatory cells. It takes chloride, and what do you create? Bleach. Isn't bleach a great disinfectant? We all make bleach inside that's going to make a free radical that's going to destroy the microorganism and break bonds. So should you pour bleach into a wound? No, because bleach is very toxic. You want micro amounts of bleach, not massive. Hydrogen peroxide should only be put in a wound where it's sizzling and bubbling is when you have an infected wound, a lot of bacteria to it. Normal wound, what should you irrigate it with? Normal saline or sterile. And if in a pinch, water is good to use. You can right from the tap water. Why? What is not growing in our tap water is bacteria. Why? What do they put in there is chloramines. And chloramine is a breakdown of bleach, by the way. So we make our own chloramines, we put it in our drinking water, so it prevents bacterial growth. So that's what you could pour in the wound too, and you'd be fine. Okay? So this enzyme, myeloperoxidase, used to be called verdoperoxidase. When I say chile verde, a salsa verde, what color is that? Green. So that's why when you think of chile verde, think of myeloperoxidase and pus. Because it's green, it's a porphyrin ring molecule. It has double bonds in it. As this enzyme breaks down, it loses the double bonds, and it now becomes yellow. And then once you destroy the molecule completely, it's white. So if you're anybody a parent? No parents yet. All right, one day you do sire or adopt, whatever. If you have a child and they call up the pediatrician and say, should I take my child to, has a head cold, should I take him to school? What's the person going to say at the other line? They're going to say, what's the color of the snot that's coming out of their nose? If it's green or yellow, they're in the heat of battle. They stay home. But if it's white or clear, they're in a convalescent phase. The battle has passed, and now they can go to school. So the color is very important because it's telling you where you are in the process. Okay? And so it becomes important. Lysozyme pokes holes in the wall of cellular organisms, cataract proteins that bind to various molecules. Acid hydrolases, we pump hydrogen ion to acidify the organism in the environment. So acid hydrolases, what does hydro mean? It takes water and cleaves other molecules and uses hydrogen, hydroxide ion, to bind to it, and you make it smaller pieces. And then elastase, this is to get rid of dead tissue because we have made of elastin, like in our skin, for example, or aorta, lung, and other tissues, so it breaks it down. And cathepsins are going to take care of extracellular molecules. What's the two functions? To get rid of what? Enzymes. These enzymes are to get rid of microorganisms, like bacteria, and dead tissue. Another important component that they have are other granules. They have phospholipase, lysozyme pokes holes in the walls of microorganisms like bacteria. Alkaline phosphatase, you need this to break down various things like bone connective tissue. Collagenase, what's the most common structural molecule? Is collagen. So when you have acute inflammation in tissue, you're constantly destroying what? That's structural molecules, elastin and collagen in your tissues. And now you're going to promote what? Scarring. The longer it stays this cell, you produce scarring because of this. Lactoferrin, because bacteria need iron, it will chelate it. Vitamin B12 is important for nucleic acid synthesis. E. coli, for example, will replicate in 20 minutes. You, eukaryotic cell replicates in 12 to 14 hours. So if I'm eating a microorganism, I want to stop its growth, so I prevent it from going through nucleic acid synthesis, and they can't propagate. And other enzymes for extracellular matrix. The macrophage also comes in after the PMNs, the cleanup, eat the PMNs, and continue on with tissue repair. They have acid hydrolases. They have collagenase, elastase. And so if the acute inflammatory process fails, and you go into chronic, the chronic inflammation will increase the likelihood of leading to what? Scarring and fibrosis, because you're chronically damaging the tissue. Because how long do macrophages live in tissue? 60, 120 days. So if they're activated, they're going to cause more damage and more sequelae as a consequence to this. Here's our cast of characters. I always like to look at images. You can look at all the words you want until you actually see it. Here we see the neutrophils, the most common white blood cell in your peripheral blood, 60-65%. Then the lymphocytes, monocytes, eosinophils, and basophils. What's that? A critical cell? We'll see that's a critical, that you're going from the intravascular highway to the extracellular compartment where the infection is occurring, is endothelial cells. They have to interact with them. And then what do we see in the right-hand corner that's overseeing this process? A macrophage. And then what do we see as an important cell is the fibroblast. And what does the fibroblast primarily make? Collagens. And collagen is very important, and they become important for the tissue repair process. So we're going to talk about migration, or start it and continue on next week. Adhesion, because we've got to get out of the intravascular highway. We have to have molecules on the white blood cells and on the endothelial cells. What tells a white blood cell, what told the neutrophils of my daughter's blood to go to her ear and fight off that zit that's got that? Because you create chemical gradients. So as you injure tissue, remember there's sacks of molecules. And other molecules will be released, like the macrophages release chemical gradients. And as the white blood cells circulate, they know where to leave to go fight the infection based on these chemical gradients that are being produced. Then in order to facilitate phagocytosis, we have various receptors on our phagocytic cells, neutrophils and macrophages, and we have to sugarcoat it. Like when you put honey on bread, you're opsonizing it to be able to eat it. So these molecules like IgG, mannose sugars, and C3b. Then we eat, we bring them in as a phagosome, and then it binds to the lysosomes that contain all these molecules and these granules, and then break it down. And then we have active killing by using oxygen like hydrogen peroxide and chloride with myeloperoxidase to make bleach. Or we use lysozyme or other molecules that do not require oxygen to kill that microorganism or break down the tissue. Okay? So leukocytes, we have these adhesion molecules. They're called integrins. And the L means leukocyte. So on the white blood cells, leuko means white. And MAC was a receptor that has C3b as complement component that's made by the complement molecules are made by your hepatocytes and liver. And there's another name for it, you can see there, that opsonizes or sugar coats it. And so it's these molecules, these binding molecules that are transmembrane, have more than one function for opsonization, or in this case, adhesion to endothelial cells. L-selectin are those molecules that are on the leukocytes. And then on endothelial cells, you have corresponding selectins that are endothelial cells. Yes. You don't see it in your?
Yeah.
All right, don't worry, just listen. I'll make sure they get put up. And then P-selectin, and then you have these other molecules, okay? So these molecules are upregulated on the cells. You can see here that make them more sticky and then the white blood cells are able to stick to it and then go through into the extravascular space. This is found in your textbook. You see how the neutrophils have a chemical gradient. They're chemokines and other molecules, and you can see the white blood cells rolling. I'll show you a movie. They have to roll. It's like putting on your brakes, getting off the freeway. And then they roll, and then they stop by the integrins, and then they slip through in between endothelial cells and to fight off the infection. Here's what it looks like. This is margination, and you can see the endothelial cells binding to the white blood cells. But that looks very static. That doesn't look very fun. But what does it really look like? It looks like this. This is what it's like to be a white blood cell. Next time you having a common cold, just close your eyes and imagine you're at the microvascular level, or a zit. And you see those white blood cells rolling on the surface of the endothelial cells. Those are the selectins that have been upregulated to slow them down. Now they're really slowing down, aren't they? Then they're going to stop. Here you see they're stopping right here. And then you're going to see one that's going to say, you know what? It's time to leave and do the work. And there you see that one. Watch. It'll flatten out. Oh, that felt so good. I squeezed right through those endothelial cells, and it's time to do my work. All in the dark.
Why does it flatten?
Because it's got to squeeze itself through, so it just pushes its cytoplasm out. So it's using its cytoskeletal proteins. So the cellular level is pretty exciting when you think about it. So that's how we think of acute inflammation. On that note, welcome to the first week of pathology, and may your neutrophils stay in your bloodstream and not have to be extravasated out. This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.